Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today a very happy birthday. We have 10 listeners we're aware of. Annalise Jenkins from Huxley. Evelyn Gore from Mason City. Gladys Deutsch from Ankeny. Hope that's right. Karen Van Buskirk from Boone. Joan Allberg from Des Moines. David Hill from Indianola. Mark Nemers from Urbandale. Doris Goring from Ames. Janet Eilers from Winterset. And Mark Daring from Duncombe. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish the 10 of you and anyone else a very happy birthday. And we have one announcement here. IRIS has a limited number of free tickets to the Sunday, April 14th, 2 p.m. performance of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, with live audio description at the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Beautiful tells the story of the early life and career of Carole King, weaving a tapestry with songs that she wrote throughout. And if you're interested, you can call the IRIS office at 515-243-6833. Again, 515-243-6833. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Christian, known as Chris John Peterson, 53, of Weldon Spring, Missouri, passed away on March 29th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday, April 5th, at Memorial Services of Iowa, 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 6th, also at the funeral home. Chris is survived by his wife Dana, children Carly, Cade, and Kenzie Peterson, mother Brenda Peterson, three siblings, and many other family and friends. The full obituary may be viewed online at www.ankenymemorial.com. Gladys Togerson from Cherokee County, Iowa, passed away in Polk County. Cards and flowers are appreciated. Survived by her son, George Togerson, and her brothers and sisters. A gathering of friends and family will take place from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th, at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory in Urbandale. A graveside service will be held in Cherokee County at a later date. Online condolences can be made at caldwellparish.com. And to send flowers to the family of Gladys, please visit their floral store. Nancy K. Sawyers of Des Moines. Services will be held on Friday, April 5th at Hamilton's Funeral Home on 605 Lyon Street. Visitation will begin at 11 a.m., followed by the funeral service at 1 p.m. The full obituary may be viewed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Eva Mae West McCoy, age 81, passed away peacefully on Sunday, March 31st at Wesley Acres. Eva Mae was born on February 26, 1943, in Coatesville, Missouri, working for Dolls for many years and retiring from Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield. She married her sweetheart, Keith McCoy, on July 6, 1963. Eva Mae was a devoted wife and loyal friend. She was very humble and extremely kind, always giving to others and someone you could always depend on. She would be lovingly remembered as a provider, devout woman of God, and ultimate lover of her family. Her hobbies included singing, playing music, guitar and harmonica, and dancing. She was an expert writer of poems, music, and even a children's book unpublished. She enjoyed gardening, mushroom hunting, Vikings football, and attending her grandkids' sporting events. She was survived by her four children, six grandchildren, and seven great-grandchildren. Also, let's see, two brothers, three sisters, and numerous nieces, nephews, extended family, and friends. Eva Mae was preceded in death by her husband, Keith McCoy, her parents, Aubrey and Iva West, and brothers, Dwayne West, Cloyd West, William West, Jerry West, and Edwin West. Services will be held at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street in Des Moines on Thursday, April 4th. Visitation will begin at 11 a.m., followed by a funeral service at 1 p.m. Burial will take place at Laurel Hill Cemetery after the services. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association in loving memory of Eva May. The family wishes to extend a heartfelt thank you to the staff at Wesley Acres and Wesley Life Hospice for the compassionate care of Eva May. Condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com.
And that concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to more national news, danger remains for a cargo ship under tons of steel. The keel of the stricken commercial vessel Dolly rusts in sediment at the bottom of Baltimore Harbor, weighed down by a portion of the Francis Scott Key Bridge that it toppled last week, complicating efforts to clear the channel, according to a senior U.S. official. Damage to the submerged steel and concrete is far more extensive and deeply buried than previously thought, the official said, who was not authorized to comment. Efforts continue to stabilize the Dolly and keep it from shifting in the current. Another official described the submerged steel and concrete wreckage as a spaghetti mess more tangled than the debris visible above the water. The Dolly lost power in the early morning hours of March 26 and drifted into a support column on the bridge, toppling steel and concrete into the harbor and killing six construction workers. At least 4,000 tons of the bridge lays atop the Dolly, weighing it down and keeping it stuck in the channel floor. Another factor complicating cleanup, a high-pressure natural gas line runs beneath the channel. Authorities reduced pressure in the line and said late Monday that it is not in danger of rupturing, according to the Command Center Public Affairs Office. A buffer zone of 100 feet has been set up around the pipeline, the officials said. Severe weather predicted for the Mid-Atlantic region Tuesday and Wednesday could make securing the ship even more challenging. The 300-yard-long cargo ship will be stabilized with anchors and tugboats. Meanwhile, the Corps engineers will continue to analyze the massive steel truss structure that fell across the Dolly and into the shipping channel. Crews began to cut up portions of the bridge on Saturday. Heavy lift cranes, including one capable of lifting 1,000 tons, will be positioned to help raise a 4,000-ton section that currently rests across the Dolly. Lieutenant General Scott Spellman, the commander of the Army Corps of Engineers, told USA Today last week that the span will be cut up into sections before removing it. Crews began cutting the bridge apart on Saturday. Cargo aboard the Dolly will be assessed and some of it possibly removed. Then the ship will be refloated from a hard grounding and moved away from the scene of the collision. The crew are still trapped on board. Also, worsening storms could bring big hail and tornadoes. A major storm system continued to slam the central and eastern United States on Tuesday as it moved across the country, destroying homes and toppling trees and causing widespread power outages. As the morning dawned, over 100,000 households in Missouri, Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee were without power, according to a database maintained by USA Today. The system has had coast-to-coast impact since the weekend, when damaging hail fell across the Midwest, and heavy rain in Southern California led to the partial collapse of a major highway. The storm has picked up force as it has headed east. It followed a dangerous day in parts of the country Monday. At least three tornadoes were reported in Oklahoma Monday evening, according to AccuWeather, and a possible tornado damaged roofs and toppled trees and power lines. Osage County Sheriff Eddie Verdon told television station KOTV DT, photos of an area north of Tulsa showed several flattened homes. Large hail fell in parts of central Texas, with wind gusts near 90 miles per hour, AccuWeather said. More than 30 vehicles were involved and multiple people hurt in a pileup in west central Texas during a storm Monday afternoon, reported a West News 9, citing Texas Department of Public Safety. The National Weather Service warned of flash floods, long-track tornadoes, and potential baseball-sized hail Tuesday in areas totaling about 50 million people. A squall line stretched across southern Indiana and a large portion of Kentucky threatened possible tornadoes, the Weather Service in Louisville said. 4 to 8 inches of snow was forecast across northern Illinois, much of Wisconsin and Michigan. The city of Evansville, Indiana, said in a post on X, formerly Twitter, that there was significant storm damage and urged residents to please be careful if you go out. There were no immediate reports of injuries in the county, Sheriff Noah Robinson told the Evansville Courier and Press, part of the USA Today network, but deputies were still canvassing damaged neighborhoods. It's a little rough out here in the county, though the city has some power outages as well, Robinson said. We're dealing with dozens of downed trees and, in some cases, power lines. As the week continues, the large storm system will bring showers and severe thunderstorms across the mid-Atlantic and parts of the southeast. The National Weather Service warned of frequent lightning, strong wind gusts, hail, and a few tornadoes from Wednesday to Thursday morning. The storm will unleash snow throughout the northeast Wednesday through Friday. With gusty winds, low visibility, and slippery roads, there's a high likelihood that the storm will disrupt travel. The heavy snow and powerful wind may also damage trees and impact infrastructure, the Weather Service said. The storm is expected to subside by Friday, says the Weather Service.
A report ties Russia to the Havana Syndrome. A former senior CIA officer who was forced to retire over a brain injury caused by a suspected Havana Syndrome attack has called for congressional hearings after a new report linked Russia to mysterious neurological symptoms that have plagued U.S. diplomats and spies for nearly a decade. The report comes a little more than a year after the U.S. intelligence community concluded it was very unlikely a foreign adversary is responsible for the sometimes debilitating headaches, dizziness, memory loss, and buzzing in the ears reported by dozens of American personnel. Quote, "It's not conclusive, but it's certainly compelling that the Russians are involved," former intelligence officer Mark Polymetropoulos told USA Today. Reacting to the new report, Polymetropoulos has become a public face and advocate for current and former U.S. officials who say they suffer from Havana Syndrome. A joint investigation by 60 Minutes, Latvia-based news site The Insider, and the German news magazine Der Spiegel reported Sunday that senior members of Unit 29155 of the Russian GRU military intelligence agency have received awards and promotions for their work related to the development of non-lethal acoustic weapons. The reporting points to attacks by Russian intelligence against American diplomatic personnel and their families that victims have long alleged. The report said that U.S. intelligence officers who had served in Kyiv in 2014, as Ukraine and the U.S. moved closer together and Russia first began to seize territory in eastern Ukraine, appear to have been tracked and targeted in subsequent postings. American personnel in Cuba, China, Vietnam, Germany, and elsewhere have all reported similar symptoms. Among those personnel were members of a team that traveled to Vietnam ahead of a visit by Vice President Kamala Harris in August 2021. Harris' touchdown in Hanoi was delayed as security officials worked to confirm she could land in safety. The strange symptoms reported by U.S. personnel have been described as anomalous health incidents, but are commonly known as Havana Syndrome because they first gained prominence among American diplomats in Cuba in 2016. Officials reported headaches, nausea, dizziness, and pain. Reports then emerged of similar unexplained symptoms from U.S. diplomats and spies in China. While the incidents left victims with enduring symptoms of concussion and other brain trauma, exams showed scant signs of injury, though doctors for some victims have reported unexplained damage to the bones of the inner ear. Some researchers have suggested Havana Syndrome was akin to mass hysteria, a cluster of brain injuries caused by the very fear of an attack. Two reports by the National Institutes of Health, published in March, found no significant difference when comparing MRI brain images of 81 Havana Syndrome victims with those from 48 members of a control group. But Dr. David Ryman of Stanford University published an accompanying opinion piece, noting that he had participated in earlier studies that said the symptoms were potentially caused by an external mechanism. Much of the new reporting focused on GRU's Unit 29155, which was implicated in the nerve agent poisoning a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter in London in 2018. Using leaked mobile phone data and other information, Reporters were able to place members of Unit 29155 at locations where American government personnel experienced signs of Havana syndrome, just before or at the time of the attack. These include incidents in Frankfurt, Germany, Guizhou, China, and Tbilisi, Georgia, from 2014 to 2021, the three news outlets reported. Two senior members of the unit were rewarded with promotions to plum political jobs in Russia's Far East. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the reports nothing more than baseless, unfounded accusations by the media. Greg Edgring, the Pentagon official who ran the military's investigation into Havana syndrome, told 60 Minutes that the U.S. government set the bar for proof of foreign actors impossibly high. "If my mother had seen what I saw, she would say, 'It's the Russians, stupid,'" he told the program. Molly McHugh, an expert on information warfare who served as an advisor to former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili from 2009 to 2013, said Edgren's comments in the new report underscore how reluctant Washington is to point the finger at Moscow. "No U.S. administration wants to have a response to Russian aggression, so they decide not to recognize it for what it is," McHugh said on social media, "which leaves Americans undefended in crucial aspects in our policy on Russia fundamentally nonsensical," end quote. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said in a statement to USA Today, he will make appropriate inquiries with the intelligence community based on the information presented publicly. Since the earliest reports, the committee has been focused on ensuring that those who experienced AHIs receive all the care and support they need. We will continue to oversee this important issue. In a statement, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence stood by its 2023 assessment that Havana syndrome symptoms were probably not the result of a foreign actor. These findings do not call into question the very real experiences and symptoms that our colleagues and their family members have reported, the statement said. The White House said in a statement that it had ordered agencies to prioritize investigations into the cause of Havana syndrome and to ensure that U.S. government personnel and their families receive the support and timely access to medical care that they need.
Putin says Russia needs new approach to migration. Concert shooting puts spotlight on workers from Central Asia. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday called for a new approach to migration after Tajiks living in Russia were detained for a deadly attack on a concert hall outside Moscow that killed at least 144 people and wounded 551 more. The Islamic State, the militant group that once sought control over swaths of Iraq and Syria, claimed responsibility for the mass shooting. Russia has said it suspects Ukraine was linked to the attack, a claim denied by Kyiv and dismissed by Washington. At least 12 people, including four accused gunmen, have been detained in Russia in connection with the attack. Most are Tajiks, who lived and worked in Russia. Putin told police chiefs that the attack was aimed at sowing discord, xenophobia, and Islamophobia inside Russia. But he said that the migration systems need improvement, as it was clear that work permits were sometimes being issued to people with serious criminal records. Quote, "We need to deeply and radically update our approaches to migration policy," Putin said, adding that some people with almost no knowledge of Russia or Russian culture were being allowed to work without proper checks. "The decisive principle should be that only those who respect our traditions, our language, culture, and history can come and live and work in Russia." Russia's room for maneuvering on migration, though, is limited. Millions of people from former Soviet republics in Central Asia have flocked to Russia's biggest cities over the past few decades, supporting a blossoming 24-hour consumer society by working as taxi drivers, cleaners, barbers, or beauticians. With Russia's 147 million population forecast to fall over future decades, migrants play a vital role in the economy, also working in heavy industry and farming. "It is necessary to ensure the interests and security of the state and society, to conserve and preserve inter-ethnic and inter-religious harmony, our culture and linguistics identity, all that is Russia's strength," Putin said. At least 277 languages and dialects are spoken in Russia. About 10 to 15% of Russia's population is Muslim. Tajik officials have said they have seen a rise in Tajiks leaving Russia since the attack, and Russian media have reported police raids against unregistered migrants. A blast ripped through a Central Asian-themed cafe in the southern Russian city of Vorons in the early hours on Monday when no one was on the premise.
And from USA Today, the FCC to vote to restore net neutrality rules. The Federal Communications Commission will vote to reinstate landmark net neutrality rules and assume new regulatory oversight of broadband internet that was rescinded under former President Donald Trump, the agency's chair said. The FCC told advocates on Tuesday of the plan to vote on the final rule at its April 25th meeting. The commission voted 3-2 in October on the proposals to reinstate open internet rules adopted in 2015 and reestablish the commission's authority over broadband internet. Net neutrality refers to the principle that internet service providers should enable access to all content and applications regardless of the source and without favoring or blocking particular products or websites. FCC Chair Jessica Rosamosa confirmed the planned commission vote in an interview with Reuters. The pandemic made clear that broadband is an essential service that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we live, needs to have a fair shot at success in the digital age, she said. An essential service requires oversight, and in this case, we are just putting back in place the rules that have already been court approved that ensures that broadband access is fast, open, and fair. Reinstating the rules has been a priority for President Joe Biden, who signed a July 2021 executive order encouraging the FCC to reinstate net neutrality rules adopted under Democratic President Barack Obama. Democrats were stymied for nearly 3 years because they did not take majority control of the five-member FCC until October. Under Trump, the FCC has argued that net neutrality rules were unnecessary, blocked innovation, and resulted in a decline in network investment by internet service providers, a contention disputed by Democrats. Rosenworcel has said the reclassification would give the FCC important new national security tools. The agency said in its initial proposal that rules could give it more robust authority to require more entities to remove and replace equipment and service from Chinese companies like Huawei and ZTE. Republican FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr opposed the move, saying that since 2017, broadband speeds in the U.S. have increased, prices are down, and competition has intensified. He argued the plan will result in government control of the internet. Despite the 2017 repeal, a dozen states now have net neutrality laws or regulations in place. Industry groups abandoned legal challenges to those state requirements in May 2022. And the last USS Arizona survivor of Pearl Harbor attack dies. U.S. Navy veteran Lewis Contra, the last surviving crew member from the battleship USS Arizona, which was destroyed by Japanese warplanes in the attack on Pearl Harbor more than 8 decades ago, has died at the age of 102. Contra, who flew bombing missions as a Navy pilot after Pearl Harbor, succumbed to congestive heart failure on Monday at his home in Grass Valley, California, in the western foothills of the Sierra Nevada, his daughter, Luann Daly, said. Contra was a young sailor standing watch on the quarter deck of the Arizona when Japanese bombers swarmed the skies over the Hawaiian island of Oahu and attacked the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Within minutes that Sunday morning, the Arizona itself had exploded in flames, smoke, and pandemonium. Contra, then a quartermaster third class, was among the fortunate few hundred men to get off the battleship alive as it crumpled and sank at its berth, taking 1,177 of its 1,400-member crew to their deaths. Decades later, he recounted how the enormous blast from the dive bomb, which apparently penetrated the exterior of the Arizona to ignite stores of gunpowder below decks, lifted the battleship 30 to 40 feet out of the water. Guys were running out of the fire and trying to jump over the sides, and oil all over the sea was burning, he recalled in an interview recorded in January 2008 for a Library of Congress oral history collection. After abandoning ship, he and others took to the harbor in small boats to recover bodies and fight fires that continued to rage for 3 days. The loss of life aboard the Arizona accounted for nearly half of the 2,390 Americans killed at Pearl Harbor and other sites around Oahu in a surprise attack that drew the United States into World War II. In his later years, Conter regularly joined an ever-dwindling group of aging veterans who attended annual Pearl Harbor commemorations in Hawaii. The USS Arizona Memorial, a white structure on the harbor surface, now stands astride the sunken remains of the metal ship. "Every year brings back memories," Conter told Reuters in a 2010 interview ahead of the 69th anniversary. "We look at the ones still aboard the ship out there as the heroes. We're the lucky ones. We came home and got married and had kids and now grandkids, and they're still there." Besides those who perished at Pearl Harbor, the two-hour aerial attack wounded 1,178 people, sank or heavily damaged 12 U.S. warships, and damaged or destroyed 323 aircraft, badly crippling the Pacific Fleet. Conter, who had enlisted in the Navy in 1939, went on to serve through World War II in the Pacific Theater and Europe, and later served in the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, retiring from the military as a lieutenant commander in 1967. Soon after Pearl Harbor, Conter attended Navy flight school and in 1943 joined the Black Cat squadron of PBY seaplane bombers as a pilot. "Shot down during one mission in September of that year," he recalled years later, Conter kept his 10 crewmates together and got them into a lifeboat. The group then drifted through shark-infested waters to an enemy-occupied island, where they took shelter in hiding until rescued by the crew of a passing U.S. Navy patrol boat. He returned to action days later, according to his oral history interview. "He was a survivor," his daughter told Reuters on Monday. "He always said, never give up."
And in brief, report to detail Microsoft's lapses in Chinese cyber attack. The U.S. Cyber Safety Review Board is expected to issue a report detailing lapses by Microsoft that led to targeted Chinese hack of top U.S. government official emails last year, the Washington Post reported on Tuesday. The intrusion, which ransacked the Microsoft Exchange online mailboxes of 22 organizations and more than 500 individuals around the world, was preventable and should never have occurred, the Washington Post said, citing the report. "While no organization is immune to cyber attack from well-resourced adversaries, we have mobilized our engineering teams to identify and mitigate legacy infrastructure, improve processes, and enforce security benchmarks," Microsoft said. "Our security engineers continue to harden all our systems against attack and implement even more robust sensors and logs to help us detect and repel the cyber armies of our adversaries. We will also review the final report for additional recommendations," he added. Last year, the tech giant said the Chinese hack of senior officials at the U.S. State and Commerce Department stemmed from the compromise of Microsoft engineers' corporate account penetrated by a hacking group it dubbed Storm 0558. The hack is alleged to have stolen hundreds of thousands of emails from top American officials, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, U.S. Ambassador to China Nicholas Burns, and Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia Daniel Kurtenbrink. Well, it's time for us to take a break. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Barbara Heck and Dennis May, and it has been our pleasure to read for you. But now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Pam Rhodes and Patty Daniels, that's me. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Pamela with our first article.
Families need immigration attorneys to unite. Ibrahima Keita waited outside the immigration court for hours, but his attorney never came to accompany him to his asylum hearing. Inside, an immigration judge marked Keita a no-show and ordered his deportation. He didn't know he could attend the hearing by himself and asked for a continuance. He didn't know it was a day that would forever change his life after many years of building a life in the United States. Keita is just one of many families separated due to the lack of legal representation. Last year, there were nearly 4 million people in immigration court facing deportation, 70% of whom lacked legal representation. Of the approximately 250,000 people who were ordered deported last year, 74% lacked legal representation. Anyone navigating a complex legal process that has life-altering consequences, like immigration court, should have a trained legal advisor at their side. It's this principle that led the Supreme Court to rule unanimously 61 years ago in Gideon v. Wainwright that people facing criminal charges have the right to legal representation, but those principles don't apply to civil immigration court matters, at least not yet. Universal representation for immigrants is possible, regardless of immigration status and ability to pay for an attorney. And states and cities across the country think so too. More than 55 jurisdictions have already established publicly funded deportation defense programs. And last year, Congress introduced the Fairness to Freedom Act, which would secure the legal right to an attorney for immigrants facing deportation and family separation. The immigration system and unreliable legal representation failed Keita when they ordered his deportation in 1997. He fought to remain in the United States by refiling for asylum and later regularly attending his required immigration and customs enforcement ICE check-ins until 2016, when his check-ins were deemed no longer necessary because of changes to the government's removal priorities. By this point, he had spent nearly 30 years in the United States, working as a delivery driver, paying taxes, and starting a family. He and his wife, Nisa Cohn, were raising two young sons, but then his life, the life he had built, all came crashing down. The Trump administration changed the U.S. government's deportation priorities and carried out Keita's removal in 2018. ICE arrested Keita outside his home, car keys in hand, as he was about to drive his boys to school. Nisa and their sons witnessed it all. "We never asked for help. We had a good life, a nice house in the suburbs. He worked so hard. Now everything is upside down," she said. From inside the ICE jail, Keita and a new legal team tried everything they could think of to stop his deportation, but the Trump administration was focused on sending him to Mali, despite the dangers and persecution Keita had fled, and they did so in 2019 after he had spent an entire year in ICE detention. Keita's new lawyers could not reverse the deportation set in motion when his first attorney failed to show up 20 years prior. If Keita had been guaranteed the right to a lawyer by his side throughout his legal battles to remain in the United States, this family's pain would likely be behind them. "Now," Keita says, "I cry a lot. I think about my two kids. Sometimes I can't even talk about it because it makes me sad. I work hard for everything I got, very hard. I lost everything. I'm a family man. I take care of my wife, my two boys. I work every day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year, 7 days a week. I just want to take care of my two kids." Keita and his family deserve to be together today, as do tens of thousands of other families like theirs who have been torn apart by immigration enforcement and little to no legal representation. And it doesn't have to be this way, just as it was decided 61 years ago for people facing life-altering legal battles in criminal court. Lawyers in criminal courts are necessities, not luxuries. The same should apply in immigration court, where the stakes are just as high. Immigrants deserve their fair day in court with an attorney by their side. The Fairness to Freedom Act would secure this right, ensuring immigrants understand their rights under U.S. laws, are more fairly equipped to make their case, stay rooted in their communities with their families, and remain in this country they've come to call home. This article is written by Annie Chen, who is the director of Advancing Universal Representation Initiative at the Vera Institute of Justice. Nicole Malaku is the executive director of the National Partnership for New Americans.
Thank you, Pam. Now we'll go on to some sports. Sports on TV. Wednesday, April 3rd. Hockey, National Hockey League at 7 p.m. And then TNT, True and Max, New Jersey and New York. New York Rangers, thank you. 9:30 p.m., TNT, True, Edmonton at Dallas. Basketball, National Basketball Association, 7:30 on ESPN, Oklahoma City at Boston. 10 p.m. ESPN, Cleveland at Phoenix. Baseball, Major League Baseball, 1:05 p.m. MLBN, Cincinnati at Philadelphia. 1:30 p.m. MLBN, ESPN, Texas at Tampa Bay. 4:10 p.m. MLBN Cleveland at Seattle. MLBN St. Louis at San Diego. 8:10 p.m. MLBN Toronto at Houston. 10:10 p.m. MLBN San Francisco at L.A. Dodgers. And for soccer, English Premier League, 2:30 p.m. PEACE Brighton and Hove Albion at Brentford. And then USA, NBCU, Luton Town at Arsenal. 3:15 p.m., PEAC, Aston Villa at Manchester City. And I'm going to read a short article, if I can find one. Actually, they're all pretty long, but Roster Depth, Another Layer for South Carolina. Written for us by Nancy Armour. Albany, South Carolina can suck the oxygen out of a room and the hope from an opponent's heart. With a roster so deep you can barely see the end of it, South Carolina is never truly in trouble. Oh, an opponent might think so. Staying within striking distance and feeling as if it can overtake the Gamecocks with another bucket or two. Little do they know South Carolina is just biding its time until, boom, the Gamecocks take off on a run and their opponent is left wondering what the heck just happened and checking for tread marks on their back. Take Sunday's game against Oregon State, which South Carolina won 70-58 to advance to the Final Four for a fourth consecutive season. The Gamecocks, the overall number one seed in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament, will face North Carolina State on Friday in Cleveland. Despite being deep in foul trouble and getting beaten on the boards, the Beavers go to within 2:43-41 on a layup by Reagan Beers with 6:08 left in the third quarter. Two possessions later, Tahina Panpau missed a three-pointer, and that's when it happened. Raven Johnson snagged the rebound and drilled a 3.90 seconds later. She fed Tessa Johnson for a three-point South Carolina. Oh, for a three. Excuse me. She fed Tessa Johnson for a three. South Carolina harassed Oregon State into a bad shot on the other end and got the rebound. And Johnson scored on a driving layup. Another forced turnover led to Sonia Fagan's driving layup after an Oregon State miss. South Carolina kept its possession alive with not one, not two, but three offensive rebounds before Fegan finally scoped on a putback. South Carolina's lead was now at 14. It had taken all of about 3 minutes. Raven hit a three first, and me and Powell were saying she opened up the basket for us, Johnson said. I remember she passed it to me, and I just let it go, and then it brought momentum to the team. The Gamecocks are not invincible, despite what their unbeaten record suggests. They got tested by Indiana and Oregon State, but they're smart and they're opportunistic, and their ability to work themselves out of a jam should not be underestimated. For this particular year, we've responded, and it's produced wins, Gamecocks coach Don Staley said. It's not always like that, but with this particular team, it is them being able to lock in and execute what we need them to execute. And when it's not executed perfectly, they figure out a way on their own to make some plays. Because a lot of times when you're making these runs, it isn't a coach saying this, this, this. It is players making plays. It's them giving an extra effort. South Carolina's improved three-point shooting also helps when it needs to deliver the dagger. The Gamecocks are shooting a little over 39% from three-point range this season, which is significantly better than the 30% they shot last year. It should be no surprise that when South Carolina makes one of its soul-sucking runs, a shot from deep is usually involved. The difference in this team is their ability to consistently knock down threes. That's what makes them what they are, in my opinion, Oregon State coach Scott Rex said. South Carolina will always be a great rebounding team. They'll always have an inside presence. They always have. They'll always have people that can really defend and disrupt. They haven't always had consistent perimeter scoring, and this team does. That's what ended up hurting us. Oregon State would whittle the lead back down to 62-58 late in the fourth quarter, but it was largely an academic exercise. The Beavers had had their chance in the third quarter, and South Carolina had crushed it. We had to be near flawless, and we just weren't able, Rook said. We just weren't quite flawless enough. It might be small consolation, but the Beavers are hardly alone. South Carolina has won all but six games this season by 10 or more points. The Gamecocks have options upon options upon options. But what makes this South Carolina team so frightening is its refusal to buckle. It is always finds somehow. Some way, someone to create distance when an opponent is closing in. The Gamecocks cut down the net Sunday as the Albany won regional championship. Champions. Albany number one regional champions. Unless there's a team that can reel them in, stop those runs before the game gets out of hand, they'll be doing the same thing next Sunday.
Here's an article about college men's basketball. Cautious optimism that McCollum and Drake are a good fit. This article is written by Randy Peterson. A friend, knowing I'm a Drake grad, called to ask my thoughts on the new men's basketball coach. Not knowing a ton about Northwest Missouri State's Ben McCollum, I deferred to something in which I truly believe. In Brian Harden, I trust. Knowing the Drake Athletics Director's college basketball knowledge and background, and Notre Dame and Marquette pedigrees, I see no reason to think otherwise about Darian DeVries's replacement. He's an Iowan. McCollum was born in Iowa City and grew up in Storm Lake. He knows the territory and the kind of player Drake can get. Like DeVries before him, McCollum appears to fit an athletics department's culture that includes Iowans everywhere, like women's coach Allison Pullman, Wellsburg Steamboat Rock, and UNI, Drake Relays director Blake Bolden, Clark of Osceola, and Harden, West Des Moines Valley. He's not a job hunter. McCollum spent 15 seasons at Northwest Missouri State, where he won 4 NC2A Division II national championships in 2017, 2019, 2021, and 2022. And trust me, there's that word again, we've seen a here today, gone tomorrow Bulldogs coach or two before. Nico something or other comes to mind. Kino Davis left after one season. Between 2014 and 2018, the Bulldogs' head coaches were Ray Gialetti, Jeff Rutter, interim, and Nico Medved. He's respected. McCollum earned 5 NABC Division II National Coach of the Year awards, the most in Division II history. He led Northwest Missouri State to at least 21 wins in each of the last 13 seasons. 5 of those seasons included 30-plus wins, highlighted by an undefeated 38-0 record in 2018 to 2019. Bulldog fans, it doesn't get much better than that. And furthermore, I don't know what Hardin's candidate pool looked like, but I'm pretty sure former West Virginia coach Bob Huggins was not on the list. I bring up the Hall of Famer because back when the Bulldogs were searching for a Gary Garner replacement after the 1988 season, the candidates were Tom Altomarco, who got the job, Jim Molinari, and Huggs. I've never spoken with the new coach, but I guarantee you he knows this will be one of those pushing a rock uphill endeavors. 7 players from last season's team were transferring the last time I looked at the portal. All 5 starters are gone from the team that lost against Washington State in the NC2A tournament last week, including all-world Tucker DeVries. That's a gigantic roster overhaul, especially at a place like Drake, where blue blood players don't necessarily flock unless your pops is the head coach. To say McCollum will be starting a program from scratch might be touching the surface. This will be the toughest of all remakes for sure. But enough of realistic negative. At least it's been proven that Drake basketball can be a big-time Missouri Valley Conference winner. DeVries coached consecutive MVC titles. His teams have been to 3 NC2A tournaments over the past 4 seasons. His son is a multi-time MVC Player of the Year. In 6 seasons, his Drake teams went 150-55. They won 20 or more games in each DeVries season. And now McCollum, whose Northwest Missouri State team last season averaged 73.6 points a game, limited opponents to 56.3, and forced an average of 14.3 turnovers a game. Bulldog fans have been used to the relatively high-scoring games, and it looks like they could get it once McCollum rebuilds the roster. Ben McCollum is a special basketball coach who understands the connection between culture and winning, Marquette coach Shaka Smart said in Drake's press release. He possesses a rare combination of tremendous relational skills, extreme work ethic, and an innate ability to evaluate and develop talent, and a terrific basketball mind. Drake has hit an absolute home run with this hire. That's good enough for me. Columnist Randy Peterson, 52nd year writing sports for the Des Moines Register. You can reach him at rpeterson@dmreg.com or on X at Randy Pete and at DesMoinesRegister.com/cyclone text.
Thank you. Hawkeyes topple LSU to reach 2nd straight Final Four. Written for us by Dargan Southern of the Register. Albany, New York. When it finally reached time to stop the talking and start the shooting, Iowa and LSU shouldered massive expectations to make this women's basketball sequel just as riveting as the first. Caitlin Clark rarely misses a chance to shine. Clark dazzled Albany's MVP Arena and millions more watching around the country, as she has all season, propelling the number one seed Hawkeyes back to the Final Four with Monday's 94-87 Elite Eight win over LSU. Yet another elite accomplishment that once seemed far-fetched has been normalized with Clark at the controls. You've got to be completely locked in on what's happening between the lines, said Clark, who poured in 41 points and 12 assists while splashing home 9 trays. I thought our team did a really good job of that. It wasn't so-and-so made a bad call. It wasn't like, oh my God, you've made 3 shots in a row. It was all about us and what we need to do. And I think that is one of the reasons we won the game, honestly. One purple-clad defender after another rotated onto the player whose fears are few, trying to desperately slow the speeding train they saw coming from a million miles away. But Clark is inevitable, even if you know what to do. LSU got the best of her and lost her national title game, but Clark wasn't wilting against this foe twice. Lahe Johnson gave it a go. Nothing. Last tear, Poa dished out her best shot. Nothing. Neither struggled like Haley Van Lith, though, unable to limit anything as Clark launched one crushing tray after another over her. The first significant daggers arrived midway through the third quarter as Clark drained 3 trays in 3 minutes to ignite the building Iowa turned into a de facto home affair yet again. Iowa went up 13 shortly after and created a wall of frustration LSU couldn't knock down. The Tigers sat in a double-digit hole for the final 5 minutes as the black and gold walls caved in on their repeat bid. When the NCAA tournament brackets were revealed on Selection Sunday, many wondered if the Hawkeyes had too tough a region to make a Final Four return. LSU was an undervalued number 3 seed, they said. Number 2 seed UCLA was no cakewalk at the bottom of the bracket, they said. The familiarity of Colorado or Kansas State could be problematic, they said. Many wondered if the Hawkeyes were in danger. Turns out they are the danger. We were just resilient, Clark said. We never hung our head when things didn't go our way, and that can get you a long way. I'm just proud of this group to go back to the Final Four. You enjoy this, and then you get to Cleveland, and then you start prepping for your next game. We want to win 2 more, and I think we have the power to do that. Dargan Southard is a sports trending reporter, and he covers Iowa athletics for the Des Moines Register and HawkCentral.com. And if you want to, you can email him at msouthard@gannett.com or follow him on Twitter at Dargan Southard. And we are just about ready to go to Dear Abby, and I think I'll go ahead and have Pamela do that. Pam?
Disturbing secret revealed as farmstead changes hands. Dear Abby, I need a second opinion. My grandfather sold me an old farmstead that had been in the family for 200 years. Last week, he showed me a wooded area behind the barn with a human skull. He told me that when his father died more than 50 years ago, he was curious about how long it would take for a body to decompose, so he left his body in the woods to keep track of its progress. He has 50 years' worth of pictures and notes. He told the rest of the family that great-grandpa had been cremated. At this point, the skull is all that's left. I checked with a lawyer who tells me that in my state, no laws were broken. That said, I don't want my great-grandfather's skull sitting in the woods behind my barn. My husband says I should quietly bury it, burn the pictures and notes, and forget about it. That just doesn't feel right to me. It feels like I'm helping my grandfather get away with something, and it feels icky. Should I tell the rest of the family or continue allowing them to believe that great-granddad was cremated? I'm resenting my grandfather for putting me in the middle of this, and any advice you have would be greatly appreciated. Signed, bought more than I bargained for. Dear Bargained. Your letter is a first. Why do I get the impression that your grandfather must have hated his father to have treated his remains so disrespectfully? The farmstead and everything that goes with it is yours now to keep or dispose of. What you need to do is decide whether to donate your great-grandfather's skull to a medical or dental school or coven, place it in a columbarium, or bury it on your property. As to whether to tell the rest of the family, what positive thing would be accomplished by sharing this unpleasantness with them? You are a caring individual. Let your conscience be your guide. Dear Abby, I'm a full-figured 25-year-old woman who lives at home. My family has 3 dogs. Every night, I go into my mother and father's bedroom to pick up the youngest one to hold for a few minutes and say goodnight. The dog likes to sleep closer to the middle of the bed, so I need to bend over to reach the dog. When I bend over, my mother gives me a look because she says my shirt starts to reveal my body and I should be mindful of my dad. I wear long t-shirts, long pants, and sometimes bras when I'm around the house because I'm trying to be mindful of my dad and younger brother. I want to be free to not think I need to cover up when I'm doing something small, like picking up the dog. Dad is a good man. He has never disrespected me in any way as I matured into a woman. So my mother's extra carefulness bothers me. What should I do? Signed, Just Want My Dog. Dear Just Want, because at 25 you are still living under your mother's roof, you should respect her wishes. Once you get a place of your own, you can bounce around as much as you wish. And you can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com.
That brings us to the end of Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and BendSoundMusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.